Gabi!
More advanced part of the center as well. I know you graduated, but once a week we will still have a question and answer. And as I always say, you're free to ask any question you want. I cannot guarantee I have an answer, but there's nothing to be embarrassed about. Any particular issue you want to bring up, we will try to discuss in some way. So your turn to just anything you want to talk about.
So, I don't know if the Rob is aware, but there's a case of a so-called Dybbuk box. It was a box that they said it was a Dybbuk in, and it was
Dybbuk
such
box?
A box that contained a Dybbuk.
Will you buy one of these?
Yeah, it was on eBay, actually.
And what's a Dybbuk?
Dybbuk is like a demon that takes possession of you.
It was such a famous case, actually, that it sparked a major Hollywood movie called The Possession, where Matthias Jordan played an ultra-Orthodox exorcist. So I was wondering if the Rob could just comment on whether or not he knows anything about the case and whether or not and about the movie.
No, well, no, I didn't see the movie. I didn't even see The Exorcist back in the 1970s. No, the thing is, let me just say a little bit about the role of Dybbuk. You know, the whole idea of Dybbuk is connected to Inyanim of demons and the like, but Dybbuks are not demons. Dybbuks are actually, if they exist, it's not so simple, they are various souls of human beings that have not found a final resting place for themselves. The normal way things work is that there's a certain purification in Gehenna, and then a person goes to Olam Haba, and the neshama is not left in limbo. But there are certain circumstances where a soul neither goes to hell, whatever that means exactly, nor does it go to Olam Haba. Its punishment is to not have a place. It goes back and forth, not feeling connected to anything, not connected to God, not connected to the earth, not connected to the body, not connected to its innermost neshama. And that is extremely painful. The way that is described in the language of Kabbalah is kaf hakela. Kaf hakela is a slingshot, like you shoot a ball that goes from here and then shoot it again. It's like, that's the meaning of a neshama that finds no peace, or a soul. The neshama is the most godly essence that may not be corrupted, but a lot of the external garments of the soul do not find peace. Now, because a neshama needs some sense of stability, some sense of connection, even in a negative sense of being connected to the earth, it looks for a physical essence to attach itself. Normally, that essence will be taking possession of a human being. Which means that human being, in a sense, now becomes spiritually a split personality. There is the real person, and then there's this neshama that entered him looking for repose. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman actually recorded that he was an Adria, he was a witness to the Chafetz Chaim performing, as it were, what the Catholic Church uses the word exorcism, we can use the same word, performing an exorcism from a woman that was possessed. And in a sense, it's similar, lahavdil, to the Dracula stories, that when there's a holy person, this Dybbuk runs away to be scared out, so to speak. And there was a whole conversation, which this was a young girl, but the voice that came out was a horrendously deep voice, blaspheming Hashem and attacking the Torah. And the Chafetz Chaim banished this demon. Now, whether a Dybbuk can possess an inanimate object, like a box, I think is problematical. I mean, the basic is they look for a human being to enter. Sometimes they may enter an animal, but usually if they enter an animal, that's because of reincarnation. That's not because of a Dybbuk, because a Dybbuk chooses a human. A Dybbuk does not choose an animal. An animal does not give it that sense of connection to the earth. Now, is there such a thing as Dybbuk, or is this Baba Mises? So, again, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman apparently believed it was real. On the other hand, there are great rabbis who say that this is just an example of split personality, mental illness, and if somebody is exhibiting the idea of being possessed, one does not go to a rabbi, one goes to a psychiatrist, and the like. So this is a very, very big machlokas. Some consider it to be real. Others consider it to be not real. Others say it was real at one time, but we don't have those things anymore. Meaning some of the kochos of impurity are no longer present in the world. And the reason for that is because the kedusha is less. Meaning there is a concept when holiness is great, you need great powers of impurity to create a balance and a struggle. And as the holiness has gone down, so even the powers of impurity have gone down. So, not being a mekubal, I can't give you a psak halacha on this. But the idea that a dibuk would inhabit a box, I think, is not the normal understanding of how dibuks work.
I mean, is it a positive thing that there's a movie?
Oh, is there a positive thing?
from a Jewish perspective.
Well, it depends what they do with it. You know, listen. If the movie is designed to portray halachic Jews as superstitious, ignorant people who don't live in the modern world, then it's a chilul Hashem. It portrays people in a negative way. If, on the other hand, it shows holiness and kedusha, then it might be a good thing. You know, so it depends. Like any movie, you say, make a movie about a Torah community. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? It depends on what the movie says and how the movie. But my guess is that it probably is not a good thing, because these types of aspects are misunderstood and people will take it to mean that the Jews are devil worshippers or whatever it would be. So it would have been better probably not to touch the topic. Rabbi Chanan used to talk about this D-book every Purim. It was very interesting. Rabbi Chanan was a very, very serious person. In fact, Talmidim remember when he would smile. I mean, like, he almost never smiled. He was very, very serious, but Kaived Reish, very Yiras Shemayim. But every Purim, he would let go a little bit. And the way he would let go is he would tell the long story of the Chafetz Chaim and the Dibuk. So this was Rabbi Chanan's Purim story. I'm saying again?
Just a side question.
Yes.
Is it possible that popes and priests could have the ability to do these exorcisms? Because are they holy enough?
They're not holy enough, that's for sure. The question is, do you need holiness to banish a demon or a debuk? Probably not. In other words, it to some degree, it is also a skill, and just like there could be a witch doctor or a doctor that can do various things, so it may be that people with impure powers would be able to work with this level as well. So it's not an impossibility that Christians might be able to do something. Yeah.
In terms of the three cardinal sins, is there anything that would qualify as idolatry now that we would be forced to give our lives before doing? Or is that
Well, no. The halachas of giving your life for idolatry apply very much today, but how it would apply would depend. For example, let's say somebody would go over to you, like the Crusades. Christianity doesn't do that today, but they would say, become a Christian or I'll kill you. Now, according to the Rambam does say, in a censored part of the Rambam differentiates between Christianity and Islam. The Rambam writes that Christianity, which in his day was only Catholicism, because it ascribes human physicality to God, is treated as an idolatrous religion, and a Jew must give up his life before he embraces Christianity. Now, would that apply to all types of Christianity? Maybe not. Some have suggested Unitarianism, which only believes Yeshua was a Mashiach, but not that he was God, and God is God, would be not all right. Of course it's forbidden, but you'd be allowed to make believe in order to save your life. That's what we're talking about. Now, this is the Rambam. Now, Islam, the Rambam says, surprisingly enough, Islam is a monotheistic religion. It may be an evil religion with all these terrorism and murder, but it is a monotheistic religion. And the Rambam says a Jew does not have to give up his life in order to avoid professing Islam. Now, that doesn't mean he becomes a Muslim, but it means a fake statement you'd be allowed to make. Now, Rabbeinu Tam, who was Rashi's grandson, says in a Tosfos that even Christianity, which in his day also meant Catholicism, was not an idolatrous religion, because ultimately the Trinity, they do believe in the ultimate God, and therefore Rabbeinu Tam said, it is not idolatry for Goyim. Goyim are not in violation of the seven Noahide laws, but even Rabbeinu Tam seems to say it is treated as idolatrous for a Jew. So I think that in terms of giving up my life, Rabbeinu Tam and the Rambam would both be in agreement. The only difference is, how do we view the non-Jew who is a Christian? According to Rambam, he is an idolater, which has certain consequences. According to Rabbeinu Tam, at least like many views of Rabbeinu Tam, he is not an idolater. But vis-a-vis me, I must give up my life. Now, having said that, let me raise an interesting question. During the Holocaust, when, of course, the Nazis would kill anybody that was Jewish, there were a number of Jews who would simply masquerade, right? They would either, kids would live in Christian families or even adults. Sometimes there were even rabbis who shaved off their beard and dressed like priests, including with a crucifix. And they passed themselves off as Christian, as Catholic, sometimes as Catholic clergy, in order to hopefully save their lives and eventually get out of Europe, perhaps come to America or Eretz Israel. So here is the question. Based on what I just said, is a Jew allowed to impersonate or self-identify himself as a Christian if that is necessary to save your life? Now, I had just said that if a Jew were to convert to Christianity to save his life, he would have to give up his life. So it's interesting that some achronim, based on a shach, they differentiate between repudiating your Judaism and impersonating yourself as not being Jewish to begin with. Now remember, in Nazi Germany, repudiating your Judaism wouldn't help. Even if you said, I'm a Jew, but I convert to Catholicism, you would still go to a concentration camp. And in fact, there are. In fact, there's one woman, unfortunately, Edith Stein, who converted to Catholicism. She became a nun, and she got killed in Auschwitz because she was Jewish. She's very controversial because the Catholic Church actually canonized her 50 years later because she was a martyr to her Christian faith. Now that's a very, very strange idea, because she didn't die because she was a Christian. She died because she was a Jew. I mean, she didn't die, she didn't give her life for Christianity, but okay. But be it as it may, so the only way you could save yourself in Nazi Germany or Nazi Europe was not by saying, I'm repudiating my Judaism, but by saying, I was born a guy. So they say, based on the Shach, that the notion of Chilul Hashem, of desecrating God's name, which is why you have to give your life, only applies when you say, yes, I was a Jew, but I am rejecting it. But when you're simply saying, I was never a Jew, so you're not repudiating the Torah, so they actually permit that. So Lamaisa, there are tshuvos that were written even during the Holocaust that permit Jews to pass themselves off as Christians to save their lives. But if push comes to shove and the Christian puts a knife at somebody's throat and says, convert to Christianity or I'll kill you, you would have to give your life even today.
Aren't there specifications of like how many people are around and things like that?
Well, actually not, because that might be true for every other sin. But for idolatry, you must give your life even if it's private, even if it's mamish nobody else is around. Okay, yes.
I was just wondering, what's the stigma with the Steinsaltz and the Shach?
Yeah, that's an ancient question, but I guess because Steinsaltz volumes are coming out anew, so it comes again. Well, first of all, if you want to be very literal, you say Rav Shach Zichron Bracha never paskened on the new volumes. It's a different process. Like, maybe it's not included. We have a loophole there. The issue, it's a hard issue to really put your finger on. It was really not because of the Gemara itself. Yes, Rav Aaron Feldman, who used to be Rosh Yeshiva here, now he's Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, did write an article pointing out different mistakes in the Steinsaltz, but those are mistakes. Those are not, you know, every sefer has mistakes. It's not such a big deal. But there was nothing really so bad about there was a time he didn't have Rashi, but now the new ones have Rashi, you know, etc. The real Tainer was, the real problem was a book that he wrote about the Talmud, kind of an introductory book, and I'm not sure if it's in this version of the Talmud, but there's an introductory book in which he had certain lishonos, certain terms in which he talked about the oral law changing because of new conditions, new societal ideas, socio and economic currents. You know the argument that people say that, you know, halacha changes with the times, etc. There were certain people who felt that that was going against the idea that Hashem is the ultimate source of the Torah Shebal Peh, and it was given to Sinai, and this Chas V'Shalom made the Torah seem, or made the oral Torah seem, like any other legal system that changes with time and place. So because of that, there was a thought that these were ideas that were kefira ideas, so one shouldn't touch anything that comes out. Now again, not everybody was masking to that, and the truth is Rabbi Steinsaltz himself changed some lishonos, and in truth, you know, Rav Shach himself did not read English. Again, he was somech on the way people interpreted it. In truth, the lishonos can be interpreted in different ways. So I don't want to give you a particular psak on it, but all I can tell you for sure is that the taina, the ikar tainas on the Steinsaltz Shas, not the Steinsaltz Shas, they were tainas on the introductory book that was written. Yeah.
Is there a source somebody is killed because he's a Jew?
What's the
source that's called Daniel Kish?
Yeah, yeah. I'm still looking for the source. The source that is always quoted is a Igeres of the Rambam. Now, the Rambam wrote a number of public letters to Jewish communities dealing with people who were undergoing Islamic persecutions and dying al Kiddush Hashem. And that's where the Rambam says, if you didn't do it, you're not Mechuyev, etc. So, supposedly, I have not come across it, maybe I must have skipped it or something, supposedly it is said in those letters that any person that is killed because he is a Jew, even if he's not religious, that's the thing. In other words, this is a very big point. People ask the question, you know, there were, of course, many, many tzaddikim who died in the Holocaust, of course, but there were many people who were not tzaddikim who died in the Holocaust. There were people who were not from. There were people, as I just told you, who converted, although Halakha doesn't recognize the conversion, but they were practicing Christians, it didn't help them, who died in the Holocaust. And the big question we have is, well, if somebody died in the Holocaust and they weren't keeping mitzvot, and they weren't even practicing Judaism, are they considered to be the great, great holy level of dying for the sanctification of Hashem's name, which is the highest level of Olam Haba? So, without the Rambam, the simple interpretation we would give normally is, well, no. Dying al Kiddush Hashem is when you have a choice of embracing the other religion, and you don't, and you die because you're keeping Hashem's will, that's called dying al Kiddush Hashem. But if they're going to kill you, whether you're a Christian, a Buddhist, or whatever you are, they're going to kill you no matter what, you didn't make any choice, then the Pashtus, we would think, that's not al Kiddush Hashem. So the Chiddush is that there is, I'm giving a little background, the Chiddush is that it is said in the name of the Rambam that if you die because you were a Jew, and the Nazis killed you because you were a Jew, they killed the Catholic woman because she was a Jew. So the Rambam says that automatically Kavyachal upgrades you to dying al Kiddush Hashem, even though you had no choice, and even though you didn't die because you were keeping mitzvos, or whatever it is. Question is, what's the source? It's said in the name of the Rambam. I have not yet found it, so I'm still
Sarah,
looking.
That's Sarah William Malthus. Yeah. The same.
That I think is a little different, because there's an aspect of dying al Kiddush Hashem when you accept, even if you don't have a choice, but when you accept Hashem's decree, as right, and you go to your death with a Gamzu L'Tova and a Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shemayim, that's another aspect of dying Malchus Hashem. So the Asar Arugei Malchus, you'll recall, right, when the Gezerah was on them, so Rabbi Yishmael, the Kohen Gadol, went up to Shemayim, and he came back and said, we must accept Hashem's judgment with love. This is an atonement for the sin of the sale of Yosef, right? So that I think itself would make it, would rather make it al-Kiddush Hashem that way. But I'm still looking at, again, it's an amazing thing. And other people have pointed out they can't find it in the Rambam, but there are Makairis, early Makairis, that say it b'shem the Rambam. So maybe it's an oral tradition of the Rambam that he didn't write. I don't know, but I'll see. If I find it, I'll tell you. Yeah.
There's a religion called Zoroastrianism.
Yes, sure.
Out there, on like in the non-Jewish world, they say it's the oldest monotheistic religion.
Yeah, it is a very old religion. The Gemara refers to it quite a lot, not by that name, but if you read the Gemara, Zoroastrianism believes in dualities: the God of darkness, the God of light.
Because it said a lot of Jewish ideas are taken from it.
Well, okay, that's another issue. But let me just point out, this was the dominant religion in Babylonia in the time for non-Jews in the time of the Gemara. Zoroastrianism, not Christianity. In Eretz Israel, it was Christianity. In Babel, it was Zoroastrianism. For example, when Chazal say, right, the first blessing of Shema, right, there's a halacha in the Gemara that you must mention God's mastery over darkness in the day, and you must mention God's mastery of day at night. That's why in the morning, before the Shema, we say, Yotzer Or, Hashem creates light, Ubore Choshech, He creates dark, and at night we also say, Mariv Argola Lor Mepnei Choshech, right? The light is replaced by the dark, and the dark is replaced by the light. Now this is a good example, by the way, where if you know a little bit of history, you understand the Gemara better. Why is it so important to talk about the night and the dark, and the light, and the light and the dark? Because this is combating the heresy of Zoroastrianism, which actually taught that because of that duality, there are multiple gods. So before we say the Shema that proclaims one God, the first thing we have to say is, it's wrong. The God of light is the God of darkness, and the God of darkness is the God of light. Right? Now, you also see in the Gemara, and it's hard for us to understand this, that at various times, whenever Yidden and Babel would light fires, there would be Hovrei. Hovrei are like terrorists, bandits, that would come and break the windows or extinguish the fires. And it doesn't say they were violent. It doesn't say they hurt anybody. It doesn't say they stole anything. They would just go around extinguishing fires. Why was this? And what's going on? And there are various references in the Gemara. The answer is, once again, this is Zoroastrianism. That, you know, the God of night, you know, you don't bring in light. They would not have light at night. And maybe there were reformed Zoroastrianisms that had light, you know, just like anything else. But if you were a Haredi Zoroastrianism, you know, you would sit in darkness at night, because you don't bring in the God of light in dark. So it is very interesting that Badafka is a religion that very much appears in the Gemara. That was the dominant pagan religion in Babel of the time. Right, I think it's of Persian origin, and it spread to Babylonia. And you see it's very old, because keep in mind that the blessings of Shema date very early. The blessings of Shema come from the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. That is already from the time of Ezra, the beginning of the Second Temple. And already we have to combat that particular heresy. Now, whether Judaism borrowed, again, I mean, as a Maimon, I would not say that, but I will say this. There were certainly heretical sects within Judaism, including perhaps Christianity itself, that borrowed a lot from that. The whole idea of Gnosticism, you may have heard of, I don't know, G-N-O-S, Gnosticism is based on dualities of good and evil, come from two different sources, etc. That became very prominent in Christian thought. It became prominent in sectarian thought, like Sadducees and various other heretical sects embraced a lot of these ideas, and Zoroastrianism was a very big influence. That is true, because it was older than Christianity, it was older than a lot of these heretical sects.
So you say it's not monotheistic religion?
No, no, very much it's not. It is very definitely an idolatrous religion. In fact, the whole idea of the in Christianity of the devil being a separate force that can fight against God is really just a form of Zoroastrianism, the idea of good, evil. In other words, these were seen as equal powers that are duking it out, and you know, you try to bribe one or bribe the other to win. All of that comes from Zoroastrianism. But Judaism believes.
Why do they claim to be monotheistic?
Oh, do they claim to be monotheistic?
Yes,
that
is the oldest monotheistic religion.
Oh, oldest monotheistic religion. Well, I'll check into it. You know, as far as I know, the Gemara itself is regarded as an idolatrous religion. The only defense the Gemara says is that many of them were not really idolaters. They were simply following the minhagim, the customs of their forefathers, and really didn't believe it. But that doesn't go to the religion itself. I'm going to check, because L'chaira, the God of light and the God of darkness, sounds like duality to me. It doesn't sound like monotheism, but I'll check it. It's an interesting question. Yeah.
So we learned in last week's parsha that no two mitzvahs, they all have the same reward. Like we learned that, you know, the greatest mitzvah behind your parents. So I was wondering, why do mitzvahs have different amounts of punishment? Even with among capital punishment, there's four different levels.
Yeah, you're raising a really excellent question. Pirkei Avos says, just to elaborate a little bit, that treat even small, easy mitzvos with the same importance as the most severe mitzvos, because we have no idea. Now, it doesn't say they are equal. Just we have no idea. That's making a different statement, meaning it could very well be that every mitzvah may have different reward, but you cannot judge. That's really one thing to remember. That's a statement that you cannot judge the reward of mitzvahs is not the same thing as saying every mitzvah is the same. Okay, but your question is, well, wait a second. Okay, so I don't know if my reward for tefillin will be the same as my reward for shema. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's the same, maybe one is more, maybe one is less, and I don't know which one is more, which one is less. Okay. But when it comes to punishment, at least for negative commandments, we seem to very much have a sense of what is more severe. I desecrate Shabbos in the time of the temple. If I had witnesses who warned me, I could be put to death. I eat chazer, on the other hand, which is a pretty bad avera. I'm not going to be put to death, but I could get lashes 30 times. I speak lashon hara, which is spiritually an awful avera. I'm not going to get any lashes or death penalty. It's a negative commandment without a deed. You don't get lashes. So it's an excellent question. I don't have a definite answer, but what I would suggest is this. I would suggest that to some degree, punishments are not necessarily correlative to reward. In fact, you almost might say the opposite. Let's take murder. Murder, it has a very severe punishment. Okay, if I murder somebody, it's a very severe punishment, both on this earth and after a person dies. Now, the reward for murder. So let's say I went through the whole day and I didn't murder anybody. Now we ask ourselves, I make the following argument to God. You know, God, you know, maybe I didn't do so much good thing, but you know, I didn't kill. I went through my whole life without killing anybody. Don't I deserve reward? Well, if you think about it, the very fact that if you murder, it is such a bad thing, you actually deserve less credit for not murdering. You see, there's almost an inverse relationship. You could almost say, in some cases, the more the punishment is for doing something really, really bad, in other words, you deserve less credit for not doing something really, really bad. Because even a normal person, you know, any person knows not to do something really, really bad. So in some ways, the punishments are not indicating the reward. They're simply telling you, you know, what you have to avoid as a human being or as a Jew. Punishments also have other functions. Sometimes a punishment is designed to create a deterrent so you don't do the avera. So, for example, Shabbos. It might be a situation where, you know, it's so easy for me to violate Shabbos, it's so convenient. Violating Shabbos, it seems to be so trivial. I rip a piece of toilet paper. So when you have averos that people bedafka treat very lightly, you need a more severe punishment. So I guess the point I'm making is, punishments are not correlative with reward. Punishments have other functions. They either, you know, stigmatize you for doing something really, really bad, or they create deterrence or disincentives when things are very easily violated in different ways. But as I say, they're not necessarily connected to reward, and they may in fact have an opposite connection to reward, because the worse the punishment, perhaps the less you're entitled to reward, right? Just like in any example. If I'm a kid and I go into a classroom and I destroy the classroom, I'm going to get punished. If I didn't destroy the classroom, I don't deserve a reward for that. I just didn't do what a wild animal would do. But it is a good question. I do want to think about it a bit more. Yeah.
During Shabbos, during the davening, you say in English that, you know, Hashem created the heavens and the earth, and then it says he rested and was like refreshed in the English translation. And I'm just wondering, you know, what's that really conveying to us? What's that teaching us?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. The concept of God resting. Well, let's take both parts of it. One is God rests. So what does it mean, God rests? You know, it doesn't mean he takes a nap. First of all, David HaMelech says Beferish, the guardian of Israel does not sleep or slumber. So for sure, Hashem doesn't need to take a nap. So on that, the Mefarshim do explain an important idea, that God does have two modalities. God has a creating modality, and God has a resting modality. But the way that means is the following. Creating is when God creates new things. Resting is when Hashem maintains the pre-existing order. Now, he's still creating it every second, but he's maintaining. He is not innovating in creation. Right? So there is a resting mode. Now, vayinafash, which literally means rests or gets rejuvenated or replenished. So first of all, precisely because of your kasha, Chazal have a drasha, right? They understand that the word is, in its common meaning, is hard to make sense of. So they interpret it as a contraction of two words. Vay is oy vay, nefesh, alas to the soul, and that's a remez to the idea that every Shabbos God gives us an extra soul, and we lose that soul when Shabbos leaves, and we feel a void. So the use of that language is conveying the notion that on Shabbos there is a heightened spirituality, and therefore there's a loss. That's why we have spices during Abdullah, because we feel faint, and we need to be revived, and the like. Now, the other answer is that, you know, we have a klal that the Torah speaks in the language of human beings. That's called Dibra Torah K'lashon B'nei Adam. That is why the Torah talks about the hand of Hashem. The Torah talks about the ears of Hashem, the mouth of Hashem. Hashem does not have a mouth. Hashem does not have ears. Hashem does not have a physical body. But hand refers to something that Hashem does that by a human being would be done by a hand. So as a result, here is the point. As a result, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will sometimes describe himself in ways that are not true Lagabe himself, but they are lessons that we are supposed to take from that description. Meaning, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu describes the idea of working, creating, and then resting and reflecting, even though Hashem himself does not engage in that activity per se, it is to communicate an idea to me, both for Shabbos and even to some degree not on Shabbos, that you work and you create, but then you have to go sit back and you have to think and reflect upon what you're doing in order to get rejuvenated. Meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu describes himself in Eifanim that we can learn from that description how we're supposed to behave. Now, this is very important in many, many, both literal and non-literal ways. The concept of rest, in a literal way, which happens to be true as well, it refers to the notion of sleep and taking the time that you need in order to rejuvenate. It refers, of course, to Shabbos. That's mamish, the context there. And it also refers to a concept that Chazal talk about with Moshe Rabbeinu. When Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, in the Sefer Torah there are paragraph divisions, right? There are breaks, sukkah, stumos, but different types of paragraph divisions. Rashi explains the reason there are paragraph divisions is when Hashem would talk to Moshe, he wouldn't just continuously talk. He would give breaks so Moshe could think about what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him. The Netziv once said, again, this is a bit of a, maybe a controversial remark because it could be understood another way. The Netziv once said about a certain Talmud in Volozhin, I'm going to get in trouble there. He said, but I'll explain it. He said, he'll never be a Talmud Chacham because he's too busy learning. Now, what does that mean? That sounds ridiculous, and the Netziv himself was no slouch. Somebody asked the Netziv, I heard that you used to learn 18 hours a day when you were... So I said, no, I didn't. I did not have Blue Jacket Bechazov. I just learned 16 hours a day. But I did do it for 25 years. Once he became Rosh Hashiva, he couldn't keep that schedule. But for 25 years, he learned 16 hours a day, including Yom Kippur. I don't know how he managed on Yom Kippur. Or maybe he made it up after Yom Kippur. Tisha B'Av was the only time he could not do that. And, you know, I just want to tell you, you know, people ask, you know, how do I become a Talmud Chacham? How do I become the Gadol Hador? I tell you exactly. I know the secret formula because it is recorded. Although I don't know if this is true, but it is recorded that the Netziv was naturally of average intelligence. He was not a super Eloi. But he learned for 25 years, from 15 to 40. He learned for 25 years, 16 hours a day. He became the Netziv. So, you want to become Gadol Hador? I have the answer. I can promise you, if you learn 16 hours a day for 25 years, you will be the Gadol Hador. Isn't it crazy that we know this? I mean, I'm saying to myself too, we know this, and we don't do it. How could that be? Okay, but why? It's a kasha. I mean, I'm asking the kasha of me too. All right, but putting that aside, and it's not even a question, and you don't have to be that smart. I mean, a Beinoni will become Gadol Hador if you put those hours in. Okay. So the question I want to raise is, so the Netziv, who was machshiv every second of learning, he says, the guy learns too much. What does he mean? He means, and this is important, that part of your learning is not only to constantly go weiter, 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 but you got to sit back and you have to ask yourself, okay, what have I learned from this sugya? What are the klalim? What are the rules? Right? Because you can get so involved in details and details, and that's very important, that you don't see the general picture. Okay, what is, you know, like even with Rashi and Tosfos, you know what Rashi says, you know what Tosfos says. Can you read it back into the Gemara? Can you read the Gemara and say, according to Tosfos, this step means this and this step. If you can't read it back into the Gemara, you know it like blocks of information. I know the Rashi block and I know the Tosfos block. That's not it. You've got to be able to mix it up, be able to see how each word will mean this according to this. But Revach Ben Advekim, the notion of space between the parshios, means that you sometimes have to stop, as it were, looking in the Sefer and think, say outside in your own words, what have I learned? What do I know? What don't I know? That's very important. It's not a crime to leave a sugya with a lot of things you don't know. In fact, even Big Talmid Chachamim. But you have to know what you don't know. That's very important. There are two ways of not knowing. There's not knowing because I'm just confused, it's a fog. Can't leave a sugya in a fog. Then you say, okay, I got it, but I don't understand Tosfos' second answer because of this. That's okay. Write it down, make a notebook, and then maybe later you can work it out. But to identify your confusion is very, very important. Now, why, again, how do I get onto this? I was just describing the idea that when God communicates the need to rest, He is not describing His internal process, but He is giving a message for us, referring to Shabbos, number one, referring to sleep, number two, and referring that even in the process of our own learning, you sometimes have to stop at creating new things and step back and rest. By that we mean integrate what you know and try to put it together in a way. So there's always going to be a human lesson, and that is the meaning of Dibra Torah Kiloshayin B'nai Adam. Okay, stop here. Have a good Shabbos. We'll see you.
Yeah.